few have given farmers more control over their environment than the crop duster. Those magnificent men and women in their flying machines lead us to ask, are crop dusters now essential to agriculture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio program. By golly, today, the 948th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Sydney who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour, this chaotic hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron, we finally got the guest.
We did. He called in.
Well, there you go. We have a guest, and it's a good one to boot. Hey, Aaron, have you ever watched a crop duster dust a field?
No, never.
Never have?
No.
Really? Hmm. Also, producer Kelly Bayer is here. Kelly, have you ever watched a crop duster dust a field?
No. No, I haven't.
Well, gosh, isn't that amazing? And if you think about the extent to which they are now dusting fields, it'll be really amazing. Folks, to succeed in the business of farming, one must, to the extent possible, exert control over elements of the environment that affect the growth and development of crops, elements like nutrients and pests and soil. When farms were small, as they tended to be in the distant past, farmers exerted control by virtue of the tools in their hands or by the implements pulled by the beast of burden. As technology progressed and brought forth new control measures like machinery and chemical, farmers gained more and more control, and farms grew in size. As they get more, farmers get more control, the farms get bigger and bigger and bigger. Today, some farms are measured in tens of thousands of acres. To exert control over such an extent, farmers have come to rely on the services of crop dusters and their airplanes. For a few dollars per acre, these magnificent men and women in their flying machines can stop a threatening fungus, kill noxious weeds, and feed a hungry crop. In fact, crop dusters now make it possible for one person to grow thousands of acres of crops. This realization leads us to ask, are crop dusters now essential to feeding ourselves? Here to help us fly on an answer, we have Bert Atwood, who is the author of My Father Was a Crop Duster. Bert, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
I'm here.
Okay, we finally got it hooked up. Way to go.
I'm sorry for the confusion. I have what they call a magic jack on my computer, and I wanted you to call that number.
Which we did.
I neglected to turn it on this morning.
Well, that's okay. It's morning in America. We're all connected now. And
okay.
I've been looking forward to doing this show with you. As you are such a big, your family is such a big part of our area agriculture, and also the birth of an entire industry of crop dusting. And your father was a crop duster. Who was your father?
My father was H.L. Atwood, nicknamed Bud. And, well, that's it, H.L. Atwood. And
he was a crop duster.
He was. He flew from 1933 to 1946, 13 years.
And in a very real way, your mother was a crop duster, too, because she ran a crop dusting company, too.
Well, she was his partner, and he did the flying, and he was kind of the PR man, contacted the different clients and so forth, and she ran the office, and in a very real way. She collected a lot of times. She would go out to the farm when he was dusting, and when he was done, she would collect on the spot because they needed the money for gasoline.
Wow. So there was a crop duster, and there was the mother right after him collecting the money. They had a term for that, didn't they? Hip pocket.
Yep.
Pilots?
Yep, exactly.
And that's what they did to get started. But, you know, it was interesting how they got started. They got started because they were essentially right there in the Great Depression. Things kind of fell apart for everybody, didn't they?
That's true. And my father was working in an auto repair shop, and the business folded. And my mother was a school teacher, and she worked in the marina area near Monterey, California. And it was a there were two teachers, and she was the principal or the head teacher. And when the Depression got really, really bad, she lost her job because the sentiment at the time was that a married woman didn't need a job because her husband should be providing for her. And so she lost her job, so they were both without work. And that's when he was already a pilot, and he went to work as a crop duster.
Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you went to work for a crop duster, really, in what really is the salad bowl of the world, the Salinas Valley of California, correct?
That's right.
And thus, there was still a lot of opportunity because people had to eat, and that's what the farmers of the Salinas Valley provided the food, so there was work there.
Absolutely.
And he was a pilot to start. How did he become a pilot?
It was just a recreational thing.
Mm-hmm.
About probably 8 or 10 years before he became a crop duster, he started flying just for the fun of it and loved it. And he learned all the aerobatic tricks. And so for him to become a crop duster was an easy thing.
And he and your mother built the Atwood Crop Dusting Company up into a substantial business that operated from the 1940s to through the 1970s, correct?
That's correct, yes.
I got to thinking about that, and I got to thinking how intimate those crop dusters must have become with the farmers of their era, because you're kind of working with each individual farmer, correct?
That's right, and as I said earlier, my father was the PR man, and he was pretty good at that. People liked him, and I know that when he died, there were a lot of people that were very upset.
Mm-hmm. If you think about it, you know, the crop duster was probably in a position to know more farmers than just about anybody.
That's right, and as he was what would be determined or called a second-generation crop duster. And so when he got involved in it, there weren't very many around. And he ended up working all over California, as far south as Los Angeles and as far north as Lodi. And so he met all these different farmers. And then as the business grew, he would turn a portion of his area or whatever over. He would introduce the new pilots to the farmers that he knew,
mm-hmm.
and it grew in that fashion.
So it was always that personal connection that allowed the company to grow. And as we get into the subject, we'll learn that almost all, 94% of the crop dusters in modern American agriculture are owned by their pilot operators. Why is that? Is there a relationship there between, you know, having that intimate relationship between the crop duster and the farmer himself?
I think that's part of it. Another part of it is that pilots that were very good and had good personalities themselves went out and became friends with the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, they decide, well, why am I doing this for the company? Why don't I have my own company?
Right.
And I can maybe make a little bit more money. And there were quite a few instances of that in my parents' company where a pilot would come along and he would learn the trade and he'd get to know the people and then he'd go off on his own.
Well, the Atwood Crop Dusting Company was certainly a huge part of Central California's salad bowl of the world agriculture, a place in the Salinas Valley where we grow so much of the nation's fresh vegetables and fresh greens. And it took a lot of flying to get that job done, and that's the story we're going to hear today with Bert Atwood, who the author of My Father Was a Crop Duster. You are invited to participate today. If you have any questions for Bert about crop dusting or the relationship between crop dusting and agriculture and our food, pick up your phone and dial us, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Bert Atwood and you. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, when you farm crops for a living, you have to figure out some way of exerting control over the elements that affect the growth and productivity of your crops. The competitors like weeds and pests, you have to control them to the extent possible. And as farms grow in size, you look for more and more effective kinds of control. And one of the means of control that evolved in the 1930s was the aerial application of various substances, top dressings on the soil, that would allow farmers to fight back diseases and insects and control weeds. They came to be known as the crop duster. And that's the story we're working today with Bert Atwood. He is the author of My Father Was a Crop Duster. And the Atwood Crop Dusting Company was a big, huge part of Salinas Valley agriculture. Salinas Valley, of course, is the salad bowl of the world. So there was lots of work in the Great Depression because people still had to eat and farmers still had business and could grow and sell their crops. So there was work there for the Atwoods, and they took that work, and away they went. Bert, before we get into some more of your family history, I'd like to go over the contemporary industry of crop dusting and have you comment on just a few of the statistics that I tracked down. There's 1,850 aerial applicators in the United States. 94% of them are owned by their pilot operators. So this is an industry that, by and large, has avoided being consolidated like so many other industries in the United States. You know, you look at the radio station business and a couple companies have come in and bought them all up, but it didn't work for crop dusting. Why was that?
I would have to say that it's a unique industry in that it requires a lot of drive and a lot of personal attention. The hours can be terrible. You're typically a crop duster has to be up about 3 a.m. To get ready to fly as soon as daylight, and
It's kind of important to fly at the right time of day, correct?
Absolutely. You got to fly when there's no wind. Wind is a big problem. You get into what they call drift, and drift is where...
drift happens.
Yeah, drift happens. Whatever you're applying, whether it's a dust or a spray, you want it on the farm that has hired you to apply it. But if the wind comes along and blows it over into the neighbors, sometimes it has unintended results, either killing a crop or a major problem is bees.
Yeah, killing bees. So there's all, this is a very technically precise business, correct?
Absolutely.
Not a job for dummies.
No.
71 million acres of crops are protected by AIR. That's 20% of all the cropland in the United States. 100% of all forest lands are protected by AIR. That's a lot of flying.
Yes, and you mentioned 1,350 members or crop dusters. The National Agricultural Aircraft Association just held their 47th annual convention and exposition in Reno, and they have now over 1,800 members.
So that's a lot of people flying.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, here's kind of striking. The average crop dusting company has 2.1 aircraft. I'd hate to fly that point one, but must be interesting. And they range in price from $100,000 to $1.4 million.
That's what a modern aircraft costs. When my parents were in the business, it was they got started in the 30s and made a lot of money in the 40s. And when the war ended, they were able to buy old Stearmans. They weren't old in those days. They were brand new, which were used for training pilots for the war effort.
And for the folks who don't know what a Stearman is, they're the great big huge biplanes, often painted yellow, training yellow, and they have these great big huge radial engines.
That's right. I wouldn't call them huge. They're not a very big plane, actually. They were designed to carry two people, an instructor and a trainee.
Mm-hmm. And well, compared to a Cessna 150, they're big.
Okay. The engines are big. As the business grew, the crop dusting industry grew, the demands for bigger payloads and so forth demanded bigger engines. And they often bought war surplus engines from bigger planes and install them on the Stearmans so that they could carry bigger payloads and have better performance. But my whole point was that they could buy the planes in those days for pennies on the dollar as war surplus. And yes, nowadays you might have to pay $1 million for a brand new plane, but it wasn't the case in the 40s and 50s.
So without the surplus, you have to buy new planes, much more expensive all around.
Right.
Most of the aircraft, 87%, are fixed wing, 13% helicopters.
That's because the, particularly in the Salinas area, the crop, the farm sizes have decreased, and the number of obstructions, power lines, and things like that have made it more and more difficult for a pilot in a plane to avoid all the obstacles. Much easier to do in a helicopter.
And you see them ducking and dodging in and out, and you wonder how a fixed wing could possibly do it, and they really can't.
That's true. Now, in the early days, that wasn't the case. There weren't nearly as many obstructions.
Right.
And
you probably don't see them, the helicopters in the Midwest, where we're talking like 1,000 acres or something.
I can't really speak to that because I'm not familiar with what's going on in the Midwest. I'm only familiar with the California area.
Okay.
I remember well there was one pilot in the Bakersfield area who worked on a ranch that was so large that he would fill up the hopper with dust or liquid, whichever, make one pass across the field, turn around and come back and have to reload.
And that's a big field.
Well, very large.
Well, and again, you know, if you think of what it would take to control that field without an aerial application, it's almost impossible, right? How else would you do it?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's done by what they call a ground machine, and a ground machine is a it's a tank with spray rig on it, and it moves through the field and sprays on. There's also, more recently, they're putting a lot of the chemicals or fertilizer, whatever, directly into the water irrigation system. However, the advantage that the crop dusters, the airplanes and helicopters have is speed. When an outbreak of an infestation of whatever, spiders, any other kind of pest occurs, you need to nip it in the bud. And the faster you can get the material on the crop, the better. And the only way to do that really fast is with from the air.
And when they do break out, they break out really quickly, don't they?
Yes, they do.
It's almost like an explosion of problems, and you have to deal with it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to deal with it...
It's kind of like the flu virus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for the program today. We're talking with Bert Atwood, the author of My Father Was a Crop Duster, and the Atwood family was indeed in crop dusting business. They had Atwood Crop Dusters Incorporated from the 1940s through the 1970s in the Salinas Valley, the salad bowl of the world, and throughout California. We're listening to the story today of that industry and how it has impacted our ability to eat right back. Well, folks, I can't imagine a more technologically demanding job than being a crop duster. If you think about it, you have to have everything together, and if you make a mistake, you're probably not going to walk away from it. So it's something you just have to be totally alert and totally precise about. And speaking of precision, how on earth do the crop dusters put the dust or the spray where they're supposed to put it? Bert Atwood?
Well, in the old days, they used what they called flaggers. A flagger was a person that stood at one end of the field, and the crop duster would head towards the flagger, and then he would turn around, and there would be another flagger back at the other end of the field, and he would head back towards the other flagger. Meanwhile, the first flagger would move over a set distance, so that when the pilot came back, he was doing a different, what they call a swath, an area, a width of the field. And meanwhile, the second flagger would move over.
Wow.
Now, that's by and large pretty much gone now because of GPS systems. The pilot can use a GPS and know exactly where he is, and he can set it up so that he can do the field in any pattern that he desires, whether it be straight back and forth, or he can do kind of do an outline of the field or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology has really helped in that regard.
Well, speaking of being a flagger, I had an associate that I work with who was a flagger. And I, you know, asked him, well, how did you survive being a flagger? Didn't you get DDT'd to death? How did flaggers survive without, you know, being, you know, exposed to all of the noxious chemicals?
I can't really answer that. I can only surmise that the pilot shut off the application well in advance of being where the flagger was. I do know of several flaggers that were actually accidentally hit by the plane and either seriously injured or killed.
Wow. That would be a whoops, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Speaking of obstacles, you know, the crop dusters fly really low. How low do they fly?
Oh, generally 1 to 3 feet above the surface.
And how fast are they going?
Typically around 80 miles an hour.
So you're traveling 80 miles an hour, and you're one foot above the surface of the ground.
Right.
Whoo! Now, it's not a very safe job, is it? I mean, there are a lot of people that actually lost their lives flying crop dusters.
Yes, there have been quite a few deaths.
And most of them are from running into things.
Yes.
You know, the running into power lines, I think, is the most substantial obstacle. But there's also towers. And as you said, there did not used to be, in the good old days, so many obstructions. But now there are many.
Right.
And one of the things you talked about was the development of crop dusting at night. Why on earth would anybody fly an airplane and do crop dusting at night?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the problem with wind and drift, and typically the air is much more stable at night. And so that was a good time to do it. It was also a lot of times during the daytime, you might have workers out in the field, doing weeding and whatnot, or harvesting the crops. And at night, you wouldn't have that problem.
How do you crop dust at night? I'm a private pilot myself and have a little bit of experience at flying about at night. I can't imagine flying at 1 foot off the ground. How do you do that?
Well, I mentioned the GPS systems. That helps. The guys that first started flying at night, they would fly a known field where they knew if there were any obstructions. And typically it would be a field that they were quite familiar with already. And they had lights mounted on the tips of the wings. And instead of having a flagger out with a flag, they would have somebody in a pickup truck with a beacon on it. And after they made the first pass, the truck would move 30 or 40 feet. And the same thing at the other end of the field. One thing about flying low is there's a phenomenon known as the ground effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the ground effect is, it's kind of like a cushion. And the closer you get to the ground, the more difficult it becomes to get even closer. And
so it kind of holds you away, in
right.
a sense.
Yeah, and a seasoned pilot can sense that and take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. That was something I often experienced landing my Mooney, which is a low-wing airplane, and it would get close to the ground, and it would just want to coast along until it lost a lot of airspeed before it would finally consent to landing.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your family. They got their start in the Salinas Valley. Describe that valley to the listening audience. What was it like in those days?
Well, it was farms, a lot of relatively small farmers. The Salinas Valley runs basically north-south, parallel to the Pacific Ocean. And
actually, south-north, right?
Well, yeah, I guess.
The Salinas River runs south to the north at any rate.
That's correct. And the elevation, it descends from the south to the north,
mm-hmm.
and exits out of Monterey Bay. Which causes a problem in itself. There's a lot of fog that moves in. As the air at the high end of the valley heats up, it draws air in off the bay, and that brings in fog. And that happens typically mid-morning, maybe, let's say around 10 mm-hmm. o'clock.
And kind of when you want to be flying, right?
Yeah. So they need to be out flying before that. And when the fog comes in, then they have to quit.
Oh. We're going to pick that up when we get back. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the business of dusting crops, or crop dusting, aerial application. Huge part of modern agriculture, to such an extent that almost one-fifth of all of our crop acres are now tended by air, by airplane. We will be right back with Bert Atwood and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Bert Atwood about the industry of dusting crops, actually controlling the environment with aerial applications of this and that. We have a caller. We have Dave calling in from Nicaragua. Dave, welcome to the Food Chain. What are you doing down there in Nicaragua?
Well, it's nice and warm down here. and it's very affordable, and it's a good place to live.
Well, good for you.
Yeah. Hey, I had a comment and a couple of questions. First of all, my comment, and I don't know if Bert could remember this, but along about 1967, we lived in Aromas, and I was on my way to high school driving in the car. And about halfway to Watsonville, right out in the middle of a strawberry field, there was a crop duster that was just planted perfectly upside down, laying in the ground. It looked like the plane hadn't any collision or anything. It was just sitting there. I don't know if you ever recall that, but that was my question: how many accidents have we had over the course of his time in the business here in the Central Coast? And the other question I wanted to ask him was I worked for Grant Construction for years at Metz Plant down in Greenfield, and we used to watch. I can't think of the guy's name now, but he was a stunt pilot, and he had a little airport down there. And his son was killed with a chemical that exploded, I think.
Wow, those are two specific things. Let's see. Hold on and see if we can get some answers out of Bert. Bert, go ahead.
Sure.
Well, I don't know on the first one. There were a number of pilots that were killed in the Castroville-Watsonville area. 1967, I had moved to Los Angeles. So I'm not really sure who that might have been.
Then what about the chemical down in Greenfield? Now, your family was connected in the Greenfield area, too. Was it not, Bert?
Yes. And
what was their family name?
I've got to look it up here in the book.
Well, he was pretty famous. The old man was very famous. In fact, he had some records set, and people used to go down there and train. Being right up the road a few miles when I was running a sandpoint, I used to get an aerial show about, you know, five or six times a year. You know, it was impressive.
You brought up something really interesting, Dave, from Nicaragua. In that agriculture is the one industry that spawned two sports. One sport is the sport of rodeo, and the other sport is the sport of air racing and air shows. And if you think about it, you know, the folk, the crop dusting community has been very big in the sports of air shows and air racing throughout the years. That right, Bert?
Absolutely. Most people know about the Reno air races, and several of the pilots from the Bakersfield area have won the Reno air races numerous times, for two reasons. They get so much practice because they're flying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, the business can be very lucrative, and some of these pilots would band together and buy, like the old P-51, the fighters from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And
with those V-12 Merlin engines.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the initial cost, but just the cost of operating it, gasoline and so forth. And another thing was the proper, for lack of a better term, tricking out of the engine, making it perform at the...
Hey, back. I don't want to interrupt you, but back to the chemicals. I think the kid down in Greenfield was killed by an explosion with, I think it was copper oxide or something. I forget what it was. But could you comment on that, on the chemicals and how dangerous they are and precautions that you guys have to take in dealing with that?
Good question, Dave. Go ahead, Bert. How dangerous is this stuff that you're applying on the fields?
The accident that he's talking about, the stunt pilot was Wayne Handley.
Handley, that's right.
And it was his son, and it was involving sulfur. And sulfur is under the
explosive.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he crashed, and he had a load of sulfur, and of course the sulfur was thrown out into the air and ignited. There's plenty of ignition sources from the engine and whatnot. And
wow. That makes it's kind of like one of those airburst bombs, and boom.
Yeah. The other thing is a lot of these chemicals are highly poisonous to humans. They're basically nerve gases, what they call organic phosphates. And it takes very little to kill a human or get poisoned. And
Now, do you wear a respirator mask when you're doing this?
How do you? Hey, we're gonna have to take a quick break. Dave, you want to hold on there? Down there in Nicolau?
No, I gotta go. But
right.
I'm listening to you on the radio.
All right.
We don't have crop dusters down here. We have oxen. I have a friend with a farm. I go, why don't you get a tractor? He says, I'm not getting a tractor. You got to buy tires and gas. We got oxen, man.
Good enough. All right. Thanks, David, in Nicaragua.
Bye.
Appreciate your call. And you can join us as well on the phones. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain. We're talking about the business of dusting crops, the spraying sprays. And what on earth do they do to protect themselves from those organophosphates that can kill ya? Do stay tuned right back with Bert Atwood and you. Well, here we are. We're back. Are we not, Mr. Aaron? We are back. Welcome, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I have a few minutes left. Dave from Nicaragua wanted to know how you can apply those organophosphates and live through it. Bert, how do you do that?
Well, the pilots wore a protective suit called a flight suit, which basically covered the entire body, and they had helmets, and they did have respirators, and they would almost invariably nonetheless get some exposure, and what was critical for that was to be tested regularly for evidence of poisoning. And there are antidotes. In my book, I talk about the fact that I got poisoned once. I was working as a swamper. A swamper is a helper who assists the pilot by loading the chemicals into the plane. I was working with a helicopter pilot, and we had what's called a mix tank, which would be, it was about 300 gallons of water into which you pour a gallon of whatever the chemical was. And I was completely protected, had a face mask on and so forth. But when I poured the liquid into the water, the surface tension of the water caused a few drops to bounce back up and hit the only place on my body that wasn't covered, which was my forehead. And within a matter of hours, I didn't feel well at all. And so I got to the doctor, I think it was the next day, and the antidote is atropine, which is a poison in itself, but works in the kind of the opposite way that the organophosphates do. And so the doctor gave me a shot of atropine, and immediately I could feel the results that I was... It was counteracting the poison.
Whew. Let's see. Let's go to John. John, welcome to the food chain. You've got Bert Atwood on the line.
Good morning, Michael. This is actually Lion John, your tail twister.
Hey, Lion John.
And you mentioned the Hanley family, and Lincoln Hanley and his wife Bonnie were friends with my parents, and I spent my summers down there. And I remember his brother, the pilot, would come. I was driving trucks. I was 12 years old. I was driving the hauling irrigation pipes out to the field. And his brother would come at me with the airplane and try and scare the hell out of me. And several times I drove off the road and into the field because he thought it was the funniest thing in the world to scare this 12-year-old kid driving an international pickup truck. And I just remembered that, and I wanted to run that by you and wish you Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you very much. That's a good one. You know, there's something about the character of somebody who couldn't, you know, fly like that. Is there not? Was your father like that? Did he have that character about him, Bert?
As far as I know, he didn't. He didn't ever make a sport out of it or whatever. He did some things. I know that in the late 30s, he flew down in the Soledad area where they had a rodeo, and he would do demonstration flying and actually fly across the area upside down.
Yeah, so put on a little show. There's always a little, you have to be a little bit of a showboat to fly those crop dusters 1 foot off the ground, 80 miles an hour in the middle of the night. Oh, my goodness. Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. We've been talking with Bert Atwood, the author of My Father Was a Crop Duster. Great story about the history of crop dusting and agriculture in the salad bowl of the world. Thank you so much, Bert, and thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.